Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun, and today I'm just going to be introducing the concept of this podcast and kind of contrasting it with other podcasts on the topic that I've listened to. Firstly, this is a podcast about game design, but it's also an attempt to be very practically useful. It tries to prescribe guidelines for better design. And, you know, there's a lot that we can fight about what is better design, but I think that everyone really has criteria, whether they're sort of conscious of them or not. Everyone has criteria that makes them value some games over others. And so I think it behooves us as game designers or as game critics to be able to explain what our criteria really are. So hopefully this podcast will help you, even if you disagree with my specific criteria. Hopefully it will give you a good sense of, you know, what criteria might sound like, and it'll give you something to disagree with, and hopefully it'll help you flesh out your own criteria in a way that, you know, makes you more able to talk about the things that you think we should be valuing in games. And, you know, I think that that's a very important part of the conversation. So that's a big part of my goal, is helping people talk about game design in a constructive way. And sometimes people use the word formalism or structuralism for this sort of thinking, which I suppose stands in contrast to something like some of the more art game movements, which are kind of, they're very much about accepting everything, which, you know, which is a good thing in some respects. I think that, you know, we have had a very restrictive set of themes and settings and things like that in video games, and it's good to open that up to a larger audience, not just white males, and, you know, more interesting themes. I think that's all a good thing. But at the same time, we do have a discipline that we're working in here called game design, and or interactive systems design more broadly. And that's something that we can get better at and be better at. And the way that we would get better at that is by understanding how it works and by having a philosophy, a guiding philosophy about, you know, this, when you do this, you get this effect. When you do that, you get this effect. And this is the kind of stuff that we have in other medium, like film and music and TV and pretty much every other creative medium. But we haven't really had it so much in games for a bunch of reasons, which I'll talk about over time. The important thing to acknowledge going into this podcast is we should want to advance the growth of our medium. We should want progress. And I think in order to get progress, firstly, we're going to have to be much clearer with the way we talk to each other. And that's going to require up front, at least, some prescriptive terminology, meaning, okay, when I say this word, I mean this. This is what I mean. So you're pointing to something very specific and narrow that can be disagreed with and that we can all be on the same page more so. You know, the classic example that I get into fights a lot about is the word game, and how, you know, a game colloquially is any interactive system. You know, Portal's a game, Tetris is a game, Super Mario Brothers is a game, Counter-Strike is a game, interactive fiction works are games, and sometimes things that are barely even interactive are considered games for various aesthetic reasons, or that they come on an Xbox CD-ROM or, you know, DVD, whatever. And that's fine. I'm not objecting to that definition, and I don't think that anyone can make a colloquial definition go away. But words have many definitions, and I think that in the world of in a specialist universe, which is where this podcast operates, really, I think we are able to say, okay, in our little world, when we say X, it means this. And so I've prescribed a definition for game, which is a lot more narrow than the colloquial definition. But because of that, it allows us to really talk about guidelines for that narrow definition for that type of system, for that form. And if you go to my website, which I'll talk about in a second, there's more detail on that kind of stuff. But yeah, the basic idea is this is a podcast about making progress in game design. And it's going to be, I think it's necessarily more destructive than most podcasts for that reason. It's not embracing everything as it is. It's sort of trying to imagine things like what could be, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now, like what kinds of things could we be doing? And not because of technology, but because of design philosophy. Advancement in our philosophy of design. What could we be doing? So I'm not talking about, you know, advancements in AI or in virtual reality or anything like that. I'm just talking about just the way we look at, you know, just because of advancements in game design theory, what could we be doing 10 years from now? And so, you know, if you look at the history of various mediums, I think that's a reasonable thing to want. You know, in music and in other, and in art, visual arts, you can see the progress happening in other mediums. Like, you know, we went from these Gregorian chants to, you know, Renaissance music and then into the Baroque and classical eras in music. And those are the kinds of advancements that I think we can make if we have a sort of academic approach to the pursuit. So that's what this podcast is all about. And I haven't really heard another game design podcast that's quite like that. I mean, there's a couple that are similar, but I think that this is going to be probably the most critical and the most formal of the podcasts that you'll be able to find on the topic. And I also think that I have a different point of view on game design, which I think is probably more valuable than a more similar point of view because, you know, you already know the more similar point of views. You've already been living with those your whole lives and you've heard them and people don't need to really hear their own opinions, you know, yelled back at them. So that's the basic concept of the podcast is a podcast about progress, about formal guidelines for design, and developing a philosophy for game design. So I should also talk a little bit about who I am. I'm a game designer. My name is Keith Burgun, and I've currently released 3 games. My first one was 100 Rogues. It was just a simple roguelike with some minor tweaks. And then my second release was one called Empire, which I designed sort of on contract for another company. And then the latest game I released this year or late last year on Android was Oro, a monster bumping adventure. And that's really the game that during the production of it, I developed a lot of my theory. And I think it's a pretty good example of a lot of my philosophy kind of in action. Not a perfect example because we started developing that game actually like in 2010 or something. So it was a good long 4 to 5 year development cycle. And, you know, it wasn't designed from the ground up with this philosophy in mind. So there were some vestigial things that are still in the game now. But even with that said, I think it's a pretty good, example of my philosophy. So I would recommend people at least just look up a video and see what that is, because I'll probably mention that from time to time. I also wrote a couple of books on game design. My first one was Game Design Theory, A New Philosophy for Understanding Games. And that's kind of a broad, it's kind of like the introduction to this podcast. It's just a broad discussion about games and progress and, you know, the kinds of things that we can prescribe for game design. And so that was that one. And then my second book, which came out this year, actually, is called Clockwork Game Design. And that one is very, very laser focused on a prescribed system for understanding and building strategy game rule sets. So it's very narrow. It won't help you design puzzles. It won't help you design toys, really. And it's just about designing strategy games. And so I've written those two books. I also have a blog over at keithburgun.net, which I write for every couple of weeks. I write a new article. And that's going to be kind of central to this podcast because one of the central concepts that I'm going to take on is sort of talking about some of those articles, fleshing them out a little bit more in real time in this kind of podcast format, but also responding to some of the comments that I've been getting. I get a lot of comments generally. I tend to post my articles on my site as well as on Gamasutra. So there's a lot of good quality comments on there, and I just like to sort of read them on the podcast and then respond to them. So that's the basic concept for... So the first part of the podcast is just talking about theory in general, and the second part of the podcast is talking about some of the responses that I get to my articles and kind of unpacking those. So that's a good, like, boil down of what this podcast is all about. There's one other thing that I do that I would recommend people watch, which is called 3-Minute Game Design. It's a 10-episode series. Each episode is 3 minutes long, and it kind of just, like, runs you through the basic parts of my theory for game design. And it's, you know, it's free, it's up on YouTube, and I really recommend that as a companion piece to this podcast. I would recommend people go and watch those and listen to those, probably, you know, before anything else. Because, you know, I don't want this podcast to just be kind of going over those things necessarily, those basics. I mean, I probably will, but I'm not going to do it in as formal and in as orderly a way as that show does it. So I'd recommend watching that. And again, the episodes are 3 minutes, so they're pretty easy to get through, I would say. Yeah, so that's the overall mission of this podcast. If you go to another thing that probably people should check out really quickly, of course, you can check out my books, and that would be probably the best way to get, you know, up to speed on my whole philosophy. But, you know, you can also, I have a bunch of articles up at keithbregon.net that are free. And also on that website, there's a tab called Interactive Forms. And if you click on that, you'll see my breakdown of the Interactive Forms, which involves a lot of the prescriptive language that I've developed for talking about game design. And so, you know, I would recommend taking a look at that, just kind of getting used to the idea of game in that sense. That's a big one. But game, toy, puzzle, contest, those are the four forms. It's pretty easy to understand, I think. But I will be talking about it more on this podcast. The other big thing that I should mention is this, concept of clockwork game designs. And I'll probably do the next episode, all on that. But the basic idea is it's a system for strategy games. It's what my latest book was about. And it is, so you start with a core mechanism, and the core mechanism is like a basic action that express it. It's kind of like the thesis statement of your game. It's like what your game is really about. So, you know, I often use Smash Brothers as an example, like just knocking people back, knocking the opponent back is the sort of the core mechanism. And from there you build a goal that's like the ultimate expression of that core mechanism. So again, in Smash Brothers, the goal is to knock the person so far back that they hit this end zone called the blast box, I think. And then you also have supporting mechanisms that are there just to support that core mechanism. And so an example of that in Smash Brothers would be the damage percentage. And which, you know, when you knock people back, it adds to the damage percentage, and it also determines how far back they get knocked. So it creates this longer arc thing. That's just one basic example. I think Oro is also a pretty good example. There's not that many games that exist that are great examples of this, because obviously game designers aren't really thinking along those lines when they're designing games. But it is something that sort of parts of it emerge in designs. So that's something we'll be talking about a lot. I may do the next episode on clockwork game design. So today, I'm going to, just to give you guys an example of like what this podcast is going to kind of be like, and also to make this episode not just sort of a house cleaning episode, I wanted to run through one of my latest articles, which is about asymmetry in games. And I'm not going to read the whole article or really even belabor every single point, but I did want to just kind of give people a gist of what this article was about. It got a lot of attention and it got a lot of comments from people. And so I just wanted to run through that and kind of give you some thoughts on what it's about and some rebuttals to the rebuttals. And that's what I'm going to do. So the article that I wrote is called Asymmetry in Games. And back in 2012, I actually wrote an article called Debunking Asymmetry. And this is kind of an update to that, because that article, the theory on it and stuff was sort of half-baked, and I misunderstood some of the problems, and there were just some mistakes in it, as I see it now. You know, the biggest mistake was I was sort of against asymmetry, the concept of asymmetry in games. I guess I should quickly define what I mean by that, which is, you know, that players have different forces. Players have different powers at the start of the game. So, you know, video game examples would be StarCraft, Street Fighter, Magic the Gathering would certainly count. Anything like that has customization would certainly count. And so I was kind of opposed to that back in 2012 when I wrote that original article. But I've realized that actually that's not the problem. The problem is actually the ability to choose these sides. Because when you have that ability to choose which one you want, there are some things that seem like positives, which are actually negatives. So one of the things that seems like positives that people like about that kind of asymmetry is, you know, it makes the game easier to learn, because now you don't have to learn all 12, 24, or 36, however many characters there are at once. You can just learn the one character. And that seems like a good thing. And in a way it is a good thing, but, it's also kind of a bad thing, because, that's one of those things that makes designers feel very free to kind of just spam up their game with hundreds of characters and just way too much content, because they are sort of thinking of it as segmented into these like many, many, many mini games kind of. And so for any one individual match, it's like, oh, well, it's just Ryu versus Chun-Li. It's not that much complexity, but there's actually all this stuff in the game. And, you know, you have to balance however many characters you have against each other. And that's kind of a big deal. And usually I would say most asymmetric games really have no chance of actually becoming balanced, no matter how hard people work on it, because there's just too much content. And every time you add more content, it's like you're exponentially making the job of actually balancing that harder. So what we've been doing to get around that is we sort of house rule in like tier lists a lot of the time. They function kind of like house rules in that they say like, okay, these are the best characters, these are the worst characters. So, you know, if you lose with the best character, that's really bad. Or if you lose with the worst character, that's not quite so bad. We create this, we sort of end up playing with it like a toy. And so that all stems from this ability to just choose which character you want to play. And in this article, I talk a lot more about, you know, why that there's some other values to the choosing that are maybe kind of false. One of them, another one that's very popular, is supporting different play styles. So the assumption is, you know, oh, well, some people are more rushdown-y. Some people are more, they want to attack from a range. Some people, you know, and there's something about your personality that you're expressing by choosing this character, and it lets you play the way that you sort of would naturally play, whatever that means. And, you know, that can seem like a good thing, but actually, most of strategy games is learning to kind of discard those things that come naturally to you, is learning to not do what's obvious and to sort of fight your natural inclinations and to do things which are counterintuitive a lot of the time. You know, so this idea of let's just support your play style, it's like, it's a little bit like, let's support your bad play. And, you know, if it were a toy, that actually makes a lot of sense. We should actually support your bad play. And a lot of games, I would say probably Mario Kart, kind of do support your bad play by making the random items make everyone, you know, even if you're bad or if you're good, it doesn't matter. You can still compete because there's these random items flying everywhere and rubber banding on the racing and all that sort of stuff. So I think that's not a productive philosophy for a strategy game where, you know, you should be having to adapt. You should be having to not just do what you are naturally inclined to do, but you should be having to struggle to learn strategy. And so I see that as kind of a problem. And I talked about that more in the article. There's a few other things. The biggest thing is just adding mass content to games. My suggestion in the article is, first of all, don't add massive amounts of content. Like, that should just be a given, I think. And I'm actually a little bit surprised that we haven't started to figure that out yet, it seems like. It seems like in big competitive games, that's just not an issue at all, kind of. Like, you know, League of Legends is probably a great example because they've got something like 127, 128 characters, and no one really talks about that or complains about it at all. It's just kind of like a given. They have, I think, somewhere around 100 items in the game, which is really just terrible. And then all this other noise in the game. And, you know, people just don't really talk about that much. And I think there's an assumption that you need a ton of content in order for a strategy game to work because people are used to Magic the Gathering and they're used to these Dota-like games. And so I think that that's the assumption, is you need a ton of content for things to work. Of course, you know, you can always bring up things like the Ancient Abstracts, Go, and chess, and as examples of counterexamples where there's almost no content, and those things have, I would say, arguably are a lot healthier in long-term competitive scenes than some of these huge recent digital strategy games. So another weird thing about asymmetry is this idea of like that you're choosing a character. So if you don't, especially like up front, it's really weird. One of the first times you sit down with a game and it makes you choose a character. And, you know, if you're thinking of it as a strategy game, how do you make that choice? I think probably the best thing you should do is just go online and look up who is the best character, who are the strongest three or four characters. And then I guess just choose one of those at random. You certainly shouldn't be choosing based on what the character looks like. That would be like moving a piece in chess based on which I like the pretty horsey, so I'm going to move the horsey. Like that's not thinking strategically. And yet I think we're expected to behave that way when it comes to asymmetric games. We're expected to sort of pick, you know, oh, I identify with that character. His theme, not even the way he necessarily moves and stuff. Now there is the aspect of like, yeah, I identify with a character that shoots a lot of fireballs. I like that. But, you know, it's like, either that is an optimal choice to choose the fireball character, or it's a less optimal choice. Like it's either, you know, as opposed to the other characters, it is more or less optimal pretty much. Unless we're assuming any of these games are perfectly balanced. So you really shouldn't be choosing based on you like fireballs. That should be overridden by your understanding of who the best character is. If this is a strategic choice, and that's the weird thing, is that a lot of the proponents of this kind of asymmetry, I hear different people saying different things, that the pick phase, like when you're choosing your character, that is part of the game. Some people say it's not. I think there are big problems either way, whether it is part of the game or whether it isn't. If it is part of the game, you know, you're making this giant top heavy front loaded decision right at the beginning of the game, and it informs the whole rest of the match, and you have no information about what's going to be in that match at all. So you're just doing it completely blind, and it's huge. I kind of am reminded of Settlers of Catan, a very popular German board game that has you placing houses in the beginning. Or another one that I like actually a lot better than Settlers of Catan is Through the Desert by Rainer Knizia. I think that's generally a pretty good game, but I'm actually so turned off by those opening moves where you have to place your starting camels or caravan leaders, I believe they're called. And it's such a huge decision, and you really don't have a lot to go on about the game state. You're just, you know, you're looking at this randomly generated board and kind of basically just trying to make, like, you're making strategic, actually it's a lot more of a strategic move, but it's so front loaded. It's so much of the game is going to come out of these opening moves. And that's really, kind of bad. You don't want the early game decisions to be really, really heavy. You want the early game decisions where the player has the least information about the overall game state to be as light as possible. And then slowly, as the player is getting more information about the game, the decisions should be have stronger ramifications. So it's kind of backwards to have this thing where right up front you just make these huge moves that determine so much about the game. And so that's a big problem that I have with the idea that choosing a character is part of the strategy game. And then on the other hand, if we decide that it's not part of the strategy game, that it's just this weird, you're actually choosing which game to play, then we have a situation where it's basically like a 100-in-1 fun pack game where you actually have all these different games. There's Ryu versus Guile. There's Ryu versus Chun-Li. There's Ryu versus, you know, Ken, whatever. And so there's that, and each of those is their own game. That's also extremely problematic because, you know, it's hard enough to make one good game. I think it's very difficult to, basically we're saying, okay, we have this force in chess and it also has to be good in StarCraft and it also has to be good in League of Legends and it also has to be good in, you know, five other games that aren't necessarily related to it. That's an extreme example, of course, but that hopefully illustrates my point about you don't want to be making 100 games at once. You want to be making one good game. That's hard enough. In fact, that's so hard that it's, you know, it's not guaranteed. I guess that's one thing I should kind of say up front, too, about this podcast, and maybe something that's different about my philosophy, is that a lot of people, I think that what we have now is really great, and or at least good, and will become great soon. Whereas I really think that we can do so, so much better. I think that we're in like the pre-Baroque phase of game design. And so I think that's a place where I rub up weird against a lot of people. You know, and people have accused me of using this like God said so fallacy, you know, because I can always just say, things are going to be much better in the future. Just trust me. But that's not what I'm saying. I don't just say just trust me or just believe that games will be much better in the future. I really actually have a lot of systemic, you know, explanations for why that would be and for what the problems are. And there's plenty of empirical evidence that shows why these things are problems. Game designers being on this constant treadmill of having to patch things like massively. I mean, Riot with League of Legends is a classic example, or Magic the Gathering releasing new content all the time and expiring old content. Designers being on these treadmills, I think, is a great example of, I mean, that's a problem. We shouldn't have that sort of situation. Like, the game should itself have emergent qualities that keep, you know, keep giving, that keep, that are deep to explore. It shouldn't be like if the developer just, like, you know, disappears or quits or goes out of business, that the game just is totally solved within a couple of months. And I often wonder how long League of Legends, for example, would continue to thrive if Riot were to just stop making patches for, I don't know, 6 months. I really wonder, like, what would happen to the champion selection pool. I think it would probably dwindle. And, you know, general strategy probably would just calcify very quickly. And I think that's because they're not thinking sort of systemically. They're thinking content-wise, which is a major problem. There's also one little funny thing about asymmetric games that I would like to say, which is this whole idea that the asymmetry aspect is important. I mean, obviously, it must be important, or why are developers adding it to the game? Yet, if two players want to, they can just completely ignore it, and they can just play Ryu versus Ryo until the end of time in Street Fighter. I mean, that seems strange to me that it's considered important, yet players can just completely ignore that aspect of it. And now that makes sense if you're thinking of things along the toy axis. And another article I should probably talk about briefly, I'll probably do an episode on it at some point, is this article I wrote called Video Games Are Broken Toys. And that's a big exploration into the idea that really we've been thinking of video games as toys all along, even the ones that are strategy games. Ultimately, we're playing with them. We're expected to house rule them, to fix them. We're expected to do certain behaviors. A great example is people having conventions in StarCraft play, people will say no rush 20 minutes, things like that. Or I've heard of Smash Brothers communities where they don't allow edge guarding and things like that. Or they don't allow people to play certain characters, or, this house ruling is so common and central in video games. And so I think that's a big reason why we accept the problems that come about because of asymmetry, is this toy-like mentality. You're playing with it. Let the player play with it however they want. Let them do what they want. The let them do what they want philosophy really is kind of contrary to the values of a strategy game. Now, I should step back on that for a second and just say that I don't think strategy games should just be, a very rote maximization calculation, do the math and then put in the answer. It shouldn't be like that. I think people will rush to that, and that's kind of a bit of a red herring, because, that suggests that the strategy game is solved. Strategy games should be nowhere near solved, in which case players have to kind of make much less certain decisions, and they have to kind of use ingenuity and think in different ways and challenge themselves and, do bold moves. So, I think that players do express creativity in good strategy games. And I think good strategy games will always allow for the expression of creativity, but it'll always be guided creativity. It won't be creativity that's just wild the way that toy creativity is. You're being creative in the pursuit of a goal. You're not being creative just to see what happens when you combine these two things. And I think that's a very big distinction. So I only talked about one of my two given solutions in that article, which was to reduce the amount of content. So instead of, 100 characters, 30, 50 characters, maybe you have 10 or 5 or 3. That might sound outlandish, but I mean, StarCraft technically has 3 characters, 3 asymmetric sides that you can choose from. There's no reason in my mind why a Street Fighter couldn't work without 3 characters, or even a League of Legends. So that was the first guideline that I had given. The other one was forced random selection. So you don't choose your character. Instead, it's randomly chosen for you when you hit the play button. And I think that's actually pretty important, because what that does is, first of all, it makes the asymmetry non-optional. You could even force random and disable mirror matches if it's important that the players have different forces. But either way, it forces players to experience the whole game and to learn the whole game and learn all the characters. Not just, there are plenty of players out there who have only ever played one character in a game with 30 or 40 or 50 characters. And, they've played against other characters, but they've never played as anyone except for this one character. And that's sort of strange, and it's sort of inefficient design, because there's all this complexity that's just not being used on that person at all. It also allows them, it's kind of like if you allowed someone to just play chess with only knights, or, only rooks or something like that. It's like you're only experiencing a small part of the system, and yeah, you're going really deep into the skill of it, but how good is that really for the health of the system? You're going to solve it faster, which people do. You're so I think it's funny, like, we're so inefficient with content. We just, like, let players just, like, burn down into these, like, into one character, and we have, like, a million other characters that just don't get used. And instead, what I'm saying is, let's do the opposite. Let's have there be just a few characters, but they're each really deep. We put all that depth from all those 30 characters kind of into those characters. And I don't mean complexity, I mean depth. There's a good Clockwork Game Design episode about depth, which I recommend watching. And that's what I recommend with the forced random. And so I got a lot of responses to that. And this is kind of going to be a test run of, you know, how it is to read some responses from people. Now, one thing, a mistake I might have made with this article was not saying up front what my suggestions were. I think a lot of people maybe read the first half of the article or so and assumed that I was saying, let's get rid of asymmetry completely, which would have been kind of reasonable given the first article that I wrote on the topic. So a lot of people responded to a argument that I wasn't making, which is that we should get rid of asymmetry, which is not what I was saying. So I'm going to skip some of the comments that that made that suggestion. Here's a good comment that kind of clear that I think makes a good. There's a good lesson in this comment, which is from someone named Robinson Ferrar. He says, "It surprises me that you're okay with forcing a random selection when you're so against things like random critical hits. If I happen to be better with one of the races, which will most likely be the case, then my chances of winning are severely affected by this roll of the die." Okay, and that sounds reasonable. I am absolutely against random critical hits. You can read my article on randomness, and I have a 3-minute game design on that as well for more information about that. I call that output randomness, and I do think that's bad for strategy game design. And if his premises are true, that it is most likely going to be the case that you're better with one of the races, then your chances of winning are severely affected, et cetera, et cetera. If that's true, then he's right. But here's the thing. It's a forced random selection. So that means that, you know, you're always playing, if there's three races, you're always playing one of them roughly 33% of the time. So that's going to mitigate this whole, like, the race you're good with aspect a lot. Not completely, though. But also, I think we have to understand that aspect of, like, oh, I have weaknesses in my play, and some players are going to exploit that more than others, that's an inherent part of strategy games. And it's like, if you're bad with one of the three races, you need to, like, work on that, and you need to, like, improve that aspect of your play. So that would be one thing I would say in response to that. But I would also say that the game should have its own identity. And a core mechanism. And if it has that, then I don't think the characters or races or whatever are going to be so significantly different from each other that you would be, like, great with one and terrible with another. I think that, you know, that can happen because we have this idea of, like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if the races were just completely different from each other and they're, like, totally oddball and strange and they play completely differently. And that does sound cool. But it's another one of those things that, like, sounds cool, but is actually bad for strategy game design. Because again, it's hard enough to, you're basically creating a giant, like, 5-in-1 games or 101 games, like one of those little, you know, packs of games that you find. Like, there was these old kind of like the Tiger Electronics things that have, like, all these different games on them, and none of them are good, but there's, like, 50 of them, so you can just, like, go through them all. That's kind of what that's like. It's hard enough to create one good game. So if we assume that it's hard enough to create one good game, then we should create, you know, there should be, like, a core action, and all the characters should do that core action. There should be some slight differences in how they do it. So that, I think that also should mitigate that problem. But, you know, that is something that players, that is a possible, I will acknowledge that is a possible downfall of forced random. You know, I don't think that any guideline we're going to ever give is going to have zero downsides. I think that this does have downsides, but the downsides are outweighed by the upsides. So I think we should embrace it. Somebody brought up a comment, this person named Cole Werle. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, Wehrle. He says, He says he's ambivalent about asymmetry, but he starts talking about the Dota 2 character draft. He says, Dota 2 begins with a character draft. Teams take turns picking characters. In a sense, the drafting of the team are the first five moves the team makes. These moves have a very long strategic dimension. There is the whole like pick ban phase in a lot of these games. And yes, I would say that is more like a decision that's happening in the strategy game as opposed to choosing what game you're going to be playing. But then we're back to that problem of Through the Desert and Settlers of Catan, maybe even more so. It's like, it's really huge. I mean, you can counter pick and you do a drafting trading thing, which is supposed to mitigate the problems of counter picking and, players kind of, choosing, you know, characters that will make them have like a good team composition that's viable. But the problem is there's so many characters in the game that it's really difficult for players to learn about all the characters and all the team makeups and who counters who. It's a ridiculous amount of information, first of all. So that alone is like really a prohibitively bad thing. And then also, it's like if somebody on the team screws that up, it can be just like game over right there. Like it's not entirely, but it could be like a huge step backwards and you're pretty much going to lose. And, you know, again, we don't want to have these front loaded decisions that are just extremely powerful up front when the players have the least information about the game state. As I mentioned, I also tend to post my articles over at Game of Sutra. And I got a bunch of comments on there, and I'll read a couple from there. One commenter on Game of Sutra, Adrian Jansen, says, in part, I don't recall if this is mentioned before, but what's your stance on asymmetry as an effective and flavorful way to achieve an exploration aesthetic? As in, even though Magic feeds on new content, the fun of the game is exploring the base, which you state don't have that much going on, with new modifiers, flavor, and options. Part of the fun in Smash is in the inviting discovery of new characters that promise you a new game to discover against your friends. Chess or Go might have this exploration going on in high levels, but is pretty inaccessible due to required skill and uninviting due to the presentation. And he goes on a little more, but I basically get the gist, which is, he is making a plea to treat games as toys, strategy games. He's using the word exploration, which if you look at my interactive systems chart, that's what toys are really all about. They're exploring the edges of a system freely without a goal necessarily. And so what he's saying is perfectly fine if we think that Magic the Gathering or any of these other asymmetric strategy games are toys. But as strategy games, my problems all stand, you know, and I do think just to address his thing about aesthetic, exploration aesthetic, or flavorful, he's talking about flavor and things like that. And, you know, I definitely understand the idea of it's kind of like fun to like choose this character and then like do all this stuff, but it's a little bit like D&D, which I understand the value of, but I don't think people would generally consider D&D a strategy game. And so I think we're kind of still in this phase where we're blurring together things like D&D and toys with strategy games. I think we don't have a strong, you know, clear understanding of what strategy games are. And that comment, seems like a good example of that in action. There's another comment by Sava Minik, which, kind of says the same thing in different words. They say, I don't see why you're so against the variety factor. Because from my article, I said, we avoid the situation where players have to choose between something that's strategically strong and something that would be more fun. And he says, or she, I don't know who this person is. People play sometimes for the sake of fun. For me, it's okay to have that in game. Focus is on sometimes. So again, we're back to seeing just sort of toy philosophy for strategy games. You know, sometimes people like it, and that's something you'll hear a lot. And this is a big lesson that I think we gotta become sensitive to, is the people like it thing. Pretty much anytime anyone says anything constructive about game design, someone else will say, you know, and now, by the way, when you say something constructive, you are making a statement. And any statement is necessarily, like, destructive of its counter statement. You know what I mean? So if I say, you know, cars are red or something, cars drive fast. The counter statement is cars are not red. Cars don't drive fast. And this statement is sort of destructive of those counter statements because it's making a positive claim. And so what people will come back at that or any of my guidelines with is, but some people like X. So, for example, output randomness in games. I've explained in as much detail as I can on my blog and in my 3-minute game design episode why it's bad. And then people will just come back at me with, but some people like it. And that's true. Some people do like it. But that's kind of looking at very, like, local maxima. That's looking at, like, in the current world with the games that currently exist and with the philosophy that we all currently have, yes, some people do like that. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily ideal for us going into the future, that that's what we should be doing, is having output randomness in games. It's not really a good counter. And it's only a good counter if we assume that games are toys and that they will always remain toys. And to be clear, I do think that there's always going to be a place for toys in interactive systems and in interactive entertainment generally. But I do think that when we're talking about the world of strategy games and things that are clearly like competitive strategy games, I do think that we got to get rid of this toy mindset. And that's probably something that'll come up maybe more than almost anything else, because I think it's a very central problem. Another thing that I should just say is there's one article, or there's one comment by Chris Hendricks, and he says, are you suggesting that Street Fighter or Super Smash Bros. Would be a stronger game with fewer playable characters? And I did say this in the article, but it's worth repeating that I'm not saying let's just add these qualities, these guidelines to games that already exist. You couldn't really just force random, I don't think even in StarCraft as it is, and have players have to do that. You certainly couldn't do that in something like League of Legends, which has over 100 characters, and everything would be terrible if you did that. So I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that you, in the very beginning design phases of a new game, that you use that guideline and you design around that. So yeah, if you are forcing random, and that means your characters probably shouldn't be too crazy complicated, so that, you know, you can easily learn all of them. I have some other advice for how to make the learning problem a little easier in my article. One commenter, this will probably be the last one, one commenter named Colin Sabry, he starts his comment off by saying, my main problem with your article is your definition of asymmetry. You always refer to the quantity of characters, but not the quality or their inherent mechanics. Even if you have two characters in your game, it is possible to create asymmetric gameplay by creating different goals for the players. Evolve would also work when there is only one monster and one playable hunter. The monster player has different strategies and goals than his counterpart. Yeah, so that's another form of the, you know, just have it be a bunch of different games. Now, on the definition thing, that brings up a good point, which is people will fight about definitions. And it's really silly to fight about prescriptive definitions because, you know, if you start off a discussion by saying, okay, let's talk about this game design thing, and I'm going to define asymmetry as X. And then someone else, I mean, it's one thing if they object, if they think that you're, there's something like dishonest or sneaky or really damaging about your definition. And I suppose that's possible here, but I also think that a lot of people just object to the very concept of prescribing definitions, even though we do it all the time. We just assign symbols to things. That's all it is. You know, it's just words are all just symbols that we assign to things, and we all understand what everyone's saying. And in different contexts, different symbols can mean different things. And so objecting to the very concept of prescribing a definition is really counterproductive, and we should try to be sensitive to that happening. you know, if there's legitimate gripes, there are, I can think of some examples of definitions that are like sneaky, that are sort of designed to get you to an outcome. And if that's the case, that is something worth objecting to. But other than that, I don't see any problem with prescribed definitions. And I think actually they will probably, I've seen so many conversations that happened that needed a prescribed, clear, narrow definition for what was being talked about very, very badly. For example, one that comes to mind often for me is Practice 2011. Practice is a game design conference at NYU that I go to every year. And at that one, they had a discussion, a panel debating, whether game designers should program. Like, is programming good for game designers or not? Or, you know, how similar are the disciplines? But the problem is they didn't really define either term. They didn't really define what they meant by programming. And they really didn't define what they meant by game design either. And so people were very much just talking past each other. And that's what's going to happen. So, you know, I'm very much for defining terms upfront in our discussions. And, you know, if that's one of the only things that I get across with this podcast, I'd be happy about that. So anyway, there was a bunch more comments, but this is a pretty good one, especially since I had the house cleaning stuff up front. And I hope that you enjoyed this podcast, and thank you very much for listening. As always, you can contact me via my site at keithbergun.net, and thank you for listening, and I will see you again soon. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming a patron by going to www.patreon.com/KeithBergun. Thanks for listening.